ठाकुर की जय। परम शिव हो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्री वासादि श्री गौर भक्तवृंद की जय। श्याम वेद भक्तवृंद की जय। गौर प्रेम नंदे ऑल ग्लोरी टू द असेंबल्ड डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरी टू द असेंबल्ड डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरी टू द लोटस फीट ऑफ श्री श्री गुरु गोविंद Chapter 11, Swayambhuva Muni advises Dhruva Maharaj. Text 22 this morning, this is Swayambhuva Muni continuing to speak. Kechit karma vadanti enam subhavam apare yutpa ete kalam apare घेचित कर्म वदन्ति एनम् स्वभावम् अपरेण एके कालम् परे धैवम् सकामं मुतापरे केचित् कर्म वदन्ति एनम् भावम् अपरे नृप एककालं परे दैवम् सकामं मुतापरे कर्म वदन्ति एनम् स्वभावम् अपरे नृप एककालं परे दैवम् कामं तापरे
Others,
Daivam, faith.
Pumsaha.
Of the living entity.
Namam.
Desire. Utta. Also. Apare. Others. Translation. The differentiation among varieties of life and their suffering and enjoyment is explained by some to be the result of karma. Others say it is due to nature. Others, due to time. Others, due to fate. And still others say that it is due to desire. Srila Prabhupada's purport. There are different types of philosophers. Mimamsakas, atheists. Astronomers, sexualists. And so many other classifications of mental speculators. The real conclusion is that it is our work only that binds us within this material world in different varieties of life. How these varieties have sprung up is explained in the Vedas. It is due to the desire of the living entity. The living entity is not a dead stone. He has different varieties of desire or kama. The Vedas say, kama karshit. The living entities are original parts of the Lord, like sparks from a fire. But they have dropped to this material world, attracted by a desire to lord it over nature. That is a fact. Every living entity is trying to lord it over the material resources to the best of his ability. This kama or desire cannot be annihilated. There are some philosophers who say that if one gives up his desires, he again becomes liberated. But it is not at all possible to give up desire. For desire is a symptom of the living entity. If there were no desire, then the living entity would be a dead stone. Srila Narottama Das Thakur therefore advises that one turn his desire towards serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then desire becomes purified. And when one's desires are purified, one becomes liberated from all material contamination. The conclusion is that the different philosophers' theories to explain the varieties of life and their pleasure and pain are all imperfect. The real explanation is that we are eternal servants of God. And that as soon as we forget this relationship, we are thrown into this material world where we create our different activities and suffer or enjoy the result. We are drawn into this material world by desire. But the same desire must be purified and employed in the devotional service of the Lord. Then our disease of wandering in the universe under different forms and conditions will end. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Vintale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Chinamani Namaste Sarasatya Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nirvishesha Sunyavari Paschacharya Sikharani Umang Yanam Timaram Dasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksuru Miritam Jainam Tasmai Sundarave Namaha Vanshikal Patris Bishchakritva Sindhu Vyeva Chakritanam Vahadevyo Vaishya Devyo Namo Namaha. So here, different Philosophers, as usual, have their different opinions on this subject matter. Of course, at least they're asking the question. It's interesting. The varieties of life and their suffering and enjoyment. Some say karma, others say svabhava, nature, others say kala, time, others due to fate, daiva, and others due to kama, to desire. Prabhupada says they're all wrong. It does not mean that they don't have some truth. We can see all these factors at work. And Prabhupada first says it's our work that binds us. Well, that's karma. But then the karma is due to kama. Here's another opinion, desire. But then we have to say, where does the desire come from? We have to go back. So here Prabhupada traces it back to the original problem. Otherwise, activities in this world, according to our nature, the three modes, under the impetus of time, under the supervision of daiva, driven by our lust or desire to enjoy. Yeah, all of those things are true. But taken by itself, to take one part of it and make it the ultimate explanation, then it's not correct. That's usually the problem, by the way, in philosophy. It's not that somebody doesn't have a hold of something true, but he has some knowledge of a partial aspect of things, but tend to take that partial thing and try to blow it up to account for everything. That's where the distortions come in. So Prabhupada says that these varieties have sprung up, it is due to desire. The living entity is not a dead stone. It has different varieties of desire or kama. Then the Vedas say kamo karshit. Kamaha akarshit. Akarshit means attracted. He's attracted by, because of desire. So he says this, that living entities are originally parts of the Lord, like sparks of a fire, but they have dropped to this material world. As if this word group came from, but said the sound of a living entity when he falls into material nature is like the group. Why? Attracted by a desire. That's kama karshi. Attracted by a desire to lord it over nature. That is a fact. Every living entity is trying to lord it over the material resources to the best of his ability. This karma or desire cannot be annihilated. People have seen that it is a desire that drives the living entity and causes his bondage. This is a very, very famous statement of Buddha in his Four Noble Truths. His first one was that life is suffering, or material existence is suffering. And the second is the cause of the suffering is desire. That's as far as it goes. It is desire. Material existence is dukkha. That's the word we use, the same word as you see, Sanskrit word, dukkha, suffering. The cause of suffering is desire. And because nothing in this existence is permanent. Everything is changing all the time. We cannot hold on to anything, yet we desire to hold on, and therefore we suffer. So then the third one is the word that's usually used is extirpate, this desire. Extirpate means completely destroy. His desire. Well, how do you do that? So that's the project. Before I became a devotee, I was studying in a university all varieties of religions. I decided I'd been a philosophy student, and I discovered that I cannot find out the truth of anything in philosophy. It's just not an option. And in fact, in the philosophy I studied, the idea of truth was even discouraged. So it was the wrong question to ask. It was more about analyzing sentences and meanings of words and things like that. So anyway, so I decided to study religion. And all the philosophers I knew hated religion, so I began to think if they all hate it, there must be something to it. Universally, a miserable bunch of people anyway. So anyway, so I went to a religion department, a new thing in America, departments of religion, the graduate school. And I thought, well, if I'm going to examine religion, of course I was born and raised with certain religious training, but I thought, now this is a big world, you know, let's see what's going on in religion. And I decided that somehow or other I got the idea that I would look to see what, because of course the problem with religions, there's so many of them and they don't all agree. It's like if some say this, some say that, some say this. So I started to study different religions and thinking, well, I'll try to find out what seems to me at the highest level they have in common. And when I discovered these noble truths of Buddha, I thought that was pretty universal. And I thought they were true. That was the other experience. The first experience that material existence is suffering. Well, Buddha just says life is suffering, is dukkha. We would say material existence, but he just says life. And I come to believe that that was true. Now, actually right there's a lot of people that don't think so. They keep chewing the thorns or whatever to try to enjoy in this world. But to me, it was true. And I'll tell you how I finally noticed. I just noticed what was going on around me. But it took a kind of shock. In my family, I was the oldest of four brothers. So my next youngest brother was killed in a motorcycle accident just when I was, you know, beginning religious studies. We were pretty close, and of course it was a shock to me, and it was also a revelation because it seemed like, well. Something like this happens. It's commonplace. People are dying all the time, but when it happens to you or to somebody close to you, it suddenly, whoa, this is a big thing. How can a human being just vanish? How can they disappear? It's almost inconceivable. And here's a relationship that gets broken off like that. And so, of course, I was in a state of great grief, but I'm also, and the whole world looked different to me. The whole world looked somehow here. This is what the world is really like. And then I realized that I'm feeling this way now because my brother has died. But I know what will happen. We'll gradually go back to normal. We will want to go back to normal. But, and then we'll say, oh, the world, you know, everything's nice, everything's okay. And few people say when you're suffering from some kind of loss like that, well, time will heal. Time will heal it. And I thought now I was seeing things more real. It was just this huge fact of death. Why should I forget it? Because then I realized, because I thought, this is a person who is, that I have these feelings about this because he happened to be my brother. I happened to be related to him. But every day, people are dying. There's a huge death toll going on all the time. Now, there are other human beings. They have brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers. They're dying. So right now, even when I say things are normal, for other people, they're going through this all the time. And so there's this huge mortality going on. There's not a war. There's not anything. This is normal life. No big disaster, no terrorist attack, just normal life. And look what's happening. And we go on being happy just by being oblivious. And I thought, this person happens to be my brother. But actually, if I had any, then that's a kind of accidental connection. But if I had any relationship to other people, who could even stand it? If I had this notion of, you know, all human beings are brothers or something like that, if I had any really notion like that, any feeling for that, it would be unbearable. So I just got this intuition of what you can call the pain of the universe. And I felt I ought to actually be sufficiently, I don't know, broad-minded or enlightened in some way that I could actually care for everybody the way I cared for this one person. But I realized, what would that do to you? So I at least saw that material existence is suffering. And it's almost unbearable. And of course, gradually, in the course of time, when something like this happens to us, we suffer, we go into grief, and then we turn to normal. Already at the funeral, people are taking alcohol and planning their next meal. They're already figuring out how we're going to enjoy. They'll get over it. But you only get over it, I realize, by becoming ignorant. By becoming stupid. By ignoring what's going on. If you don't ignore what's going on, who can stand it? So I resolved I was not going to forget. I was not going to forget. But it's very hard not to forget, because if you want to enjoy in this world, you have to forget. You can't look at reality the way it is. And when you can't, you're kind of crazy. For example, soldiers who have spent a long time in combat never return to normal. They've seen all of a sudden the space of nature of violence and death. Then it goes away. Then they return to the peace, but they never trust it. They always think at any minute it could turn and again be just like it is in war. But war is only normal life speeded up. Because people are dying all around us all the time. And we can just ignore it. When there's a war or something, we kind of have to pay attention for a minute. You know, there were some bombs that go off in the London subway. 50-some people are dead. How many people do you think die every day in London? Whenever, right? It's just because you notice it. Otherwise, it's going on anyway. The same thing, the same death, the same, you know, a little less, fewer sound effects or something like that, but basically. So life is suffering. That's a fact. It really is a fact. I believe that. And I can see how the cause of the suffering are desires, as Buddha said. And so how to become, and then he said you should extirpate desires. Anyway, I could see it was desire. I could see these attachments are there to the world. And in the fact that the death shows us how everything is temporary. That everything we do. About that time I was dabbling in astrology, and one astrology book gave this definition of death that I thought it was great. It said death is the ultimate failure to perpetuate relationships. And I realized that's the thing, in this world we're always forming relationships for our security and our happiness and our prosperity and everything. But these relationships are always falling apart. They're always breaking down. We're always in anxiety to repair them, and time keeps breaking them down. And then finally, our ultimate failure is death. Even our relationship with our own body is gone. So I realized it was the death problem. And we just have to, we suffer when these relationships are broken because of our desires. Does it seem clear enough? So I agreed with that. The cause of suffering is our desires. And then the next step was to extirpate desires. Well, I gave it a few tries, you know. But by the way, I mean, this was the late 60s, and all my friends were going out of their minds, me with them. The sexual revolution was in full fling, drugs were everywhere, and people were busy increasing their desires. It was really, really not a very good conducive atmosphere. So I was frustrated. I realized this was true, and yet to try to actually extirpate these desires seemed to be an impossible fact. And it was around that time that I finally I saw some Hare Krishna devotees. And I could not take them seriously. After all, I saw a bunch of people jumping up and down with drums and cymbals at an intersection in the middle of the campus. I was going between two classes, and there they were. I recognized something. The counterculture Hare Krishna was around somewhere. Even at somebody's wedding, he chanted Hare Krishna. This Prabhupada Happening record was there. There was this wedding, which later would be called a hippie wedding. It was a radical wedding in every respect. It was at the guy's house. It was one of my college friends was married. He was a Jewish guy with a big bushy beard, and his bride was a black lady and greatly pregnant. So there was a couple of taboos right there. They found some minister to do the wedding and read from the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the I Ching, and there was a cat walking back and forth across the altar. One of those kind of first one, and then we all went into a room and we smoked the local intoxicant. And then while everybody was in the smoke-filled room, they put on this record and we all chanted Hare Krishna. Prabhupada. That's how the Krishna consciousness movement spread in the early days. My friend Gersman was a friend of, he is a transfer student from Buffalo, and devotees have gone to Buffalo. And his friend was a guy who was later initiated, known as Tejas, and so there was a connection like that. So anyway, I saw a few, you know, a few years later, I see these Hare Krishna devotees jumping up and down the street corner, and I say, wow, this is really interesting. The missionary effort is going the other way. Well, this is an interesting phenomenon. But I have to say, the first thing I thought, my God, I'd never do anything like that. Jumping up and down on street corners. So. But anyway, I got a book, and a little pamphlet, Who Is Crazy, and but then the same guy at his wedding I was at, Steve Grossman, he called me up and says, wow, you got to come to this love feast. That's what they called the Sunday feast in those days. This love feast is far out. So it was at that time the Sunday feast was 11 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, so I had to get up early. Because, you know, I usually went to bed about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. So we went to this Sunday feast. And I really didn't have any high expectations at all. I was going in the mood of an anthropologist to examine these people. I was a sophisticated intellectual student of theology and philosophy of religion. You do not expect people who are jumping up and down in the street corner banging drums and cymbals to have a sophisticated theology, right? It's a kind of popular religion. Just like they said to Mahaprabhu, the Vedantas, why are you chanting and dancing with fanatics, right? Well, anyway, I went to the temple, and I chanted with everybody else, and I sat down. And then the devotee started. Those days, in the early days of the movement, people were, and the devotees were in the mood of chastisement. They were heavy. They didn't make it easy for people to like them. We still have some of that around, but it used to be worse. Here was a room, we were all packed into this little room. It was a rented house, and even had a Bodhi grand piano in the back of the temple room. There was a Panchatattva painting over the altar. And the devotee, the audience was all students and hippies. I mean, you could smell from people's clothes the marijuana and the patchouli oil. So the lecture is naturally about the four regular principles. And heavy, everybody around me was getting really upset. But I thought, oh, he's telling the truth. The first time I was really interested, because I knew they were telling the truth about becoming free from material desires, or just desires, as I understood them. So that was intriguing. And then the second thing was, the devotee said, who was giving the lecture, that you cannot control your senses simply by trying to stop them. Which, of course, was, as far as I could see, was the ascetic program of people who were trying to become free from desires. They would engage in asceticism. He said, this is not possible. He said, you have to give your senses spiritual engagement. And this was a new idea to me. Brand new idea. So, a new idea. Spiritual engagement. I didn't know the implications of all that. I didn't think it through, but it was just an interesting idea. I had had three courses on Hinduism by then, but every single one of them was taught by an impersonalist. Even the first professor of Hinduism was Swami Nikalananda of the Ramakrishna Mission. He came down from New York to Philadelphia and taught the religion of the Prabhupada. He was a scholar. And the second one was Dr. Chakravarti, and the third one was Dasgupta. All Bengalis, by the way, and all Mayavadis. And so, when we had studied bhakti, it was from a very Mayavadi point of view. It was totally incomprehensible what it was really about. So this idea of engagement, spiritual engagement of the senses, sounded really interesting. And then he gave a really practical suggestion: you should start with the tongue and chant Hare Krishna. I thought I would try it. In those days, we were taking very powerful chemicals for self-realization. It seemed like a set of wooden beads and some words seemed relatively harmless. So just as an experiment, I got a set of japa beads and somebody told me I had a chance, and I went home to see what would happen. And my material desires started to go away very quickly, actually. I was really surprised. It wasn't subtle. It really happened very, very fast. One thing is, I really wanted that to happen. Well, I wanted it to happen, and when it actually started to happen, then I got a little bit frightened. Because, first of all, I didn't know what to do with myself. Now I had no reason to do anything with any of my friends. I mean, my whole life just disappeared. Any material desires went away. And I didn't know who these Hare Krishna people were. I had no idea. I saw that this mantra was powerful. I didn't know where it was leading me or anything. So I quit. And then I felt terrible. Really, I maybe lasted a week not chanting. I was greasy, cloud with all of the desires all came back. And so I started chanting again very, very carefully. The implication of giving your senses spiritual engagement, if you start to think it through, you see, how can the senses have spiritual objects? Then you get introduced to the world of Krishna consciousness. And also the idea of what happens to our desires. They do not become extirpated, but they become reconverted into what they originally were. Because as Prabhupada explains in many places, that as he does in this verse, this kama or desire is there in its spiritual form, which is love of God, is prema. It is a transformation, a curdled form of prema. And therefore, the whole Mayavadi thing is wrong. That you have to extirpate Buddhist or Mayavadi, both of these things. It won't go away. Why should it be like this? When there's just matter by itself, there's no activity, there's no motion. Until the spirit soul, there's a spiritual touch, then there's activity. Then there's motion. So that's activity. But when there's activity, there has to be desire. I mean, to do anything, I have to want something. I have to will something. There has to be desire for there to be activity. And so that's because there's only activity because of the presence of something spiritual. So how is it that when the spirit is in its own native place, Suddenly there's no activity. When activity comes from the spirit existence anyway. Even in Sankhya philosophy, even the atheistic version, they say that when the Prakriti is active only because of the proximity of the Purusha, the spirit. So why when the spirit's by its own self, suddenly there's no activity? Now why is that? But the Mayavadi thing is this. They see, you see, they do everything from this world. They see that here in this material world, desire is the cause of our bondage. And we have desires because of our limited condition nature. We need this, we need that, we want this, we want that, because we're not full and complete in ourselves. So the idea, when there's no desire, you become full and complete in yourself and you have everything, so there's no need for any activity whatsoever. They speculate that. And if in transcendence there would be desire, it would be the same thing again. You'd be limited, you'd be... So therefore God has no desire. So therefore nothing happens. Nothing happens in transcendence. This is their reasoning process. About that. The same thing, if there's form here in this material world, but that form limits me, I'm this and I'm not that. God is unlimited, therefore no boundaries, no borders, no form. And so on. They proceed by this process of negation. What you end up, when you do that all the way through, is you get a great big nothing. You want to say, here's the source of everything, here's that from which everything comes, here's the greatest of all. But when you go through this, not that, not this, not that, you end up with something that's a big zero, which is the ultimate in limitation. God can't have form, God can't have activities, He can't do this, He can't do that, He can't. And suddenly He's less. Anyway, if God is complete, why can't He have form? If He has form, it's going to limit Him, then so is having no form going to limit Him. If he can't have desires, are going to limit him, and then he has no desire. That's also a limitation. And the speculation is actually not very effective at understanding what's really going on. And so so Krishna has his activities, his lila. How can Krishna have desires? How is it possible to have desires and actions of someone who's complete? Well, because he's ever increasing. He's complete and he also increases all the time. He's a person, he enters into personal relationships, and in those personal relationships, Krishna and the devotees, they always increase in love for each other. And in beauty. Why should something have an upper limit? Do the numbers, or the natural numbers, have an upper limit? No, name any number, you can always name the next one. You just don't reach an upper limit. So God is Purna, he's perfect and complete, but he also goes on increasing. Anandam Buddhi Vardhanam, the ocean of transcendental bliss is always increasing. How that increase goes on is described. That Radha and Krishna are together in the Loka Vrindavan. Now Radha and Krishna are in spiritual bodies. Again, the Mayavadis think if God had a body, it would be like this, with full of pipes and pumps and tubes and bad breath and falling out hair and wrinkles and all that kind of stuff. Nope, not like that. He has a spiritual body. And in that spiritual body, that body is not a drag. See, our body is our biggest problem for us because we are eternal, but the body is temporary. That is the incompatible situation. That's dukkha, that's suffering. But the spiritual body is just the full manifestation of the living entity's powers. Right now, Ramanuja says, while the living entities in the material world, the powers of the soul are packed up, compressed. And that whatever powers we have are expressed materially. But in the soul is in its original form, there's the manifestation of a full spiritual form. And powers of action and powers of receiving knowledge. Those are called senses. When you have senses, then you have a form. So Krishna has a form, the living entity has a form. So here's Radha and Krishna, they are in spiritual bodies. In the spiritual body, there's no difference between the soul and the body. The soul and the mind and the body and the soul, they're all one unified entity. So Radha and Krishna are together, and Radharani looks at Krishna, and she sees how beautiful Krishna is. And when she sees how beautiful Krishna is, her love for him increases. And when, as Radharani's love for Krishna increases, also her beauty increases. When we see that in the material world, her love increases, her happiness increases, her bliss increases, and her beauty increases. In the material world, when people are happy, they look better. You see a woman on her wedding day, she looks great. Even otherwise, you might not think she's especially attractive, still she looks great. So it's true that, of course, we're in material bodies, so there's a limit. No matter how happy you are, you reach a barrier. But if you have a spiritual body, then whatever is in the heart, whatever is in the mind, the feelings are there, they'll be reflected on the surface, so to speak. So when Radharani's bliss increases, her joy increases, her love increases, so her beauty increases. She becomes more beautiful. When Krishna sees that Radharani has become more beautiful, his joy increases and his love for her increases. And as a result, he becomes more beautiful. And then Radharani, when she sees that Krishna has become even more gorgeous and so on. And this goes like this without any limit. That's what happens. That's desire in the spiritual world. And because this is desire without false ego, which we cannot imagine. The devotees desire Krishna's happiness. They don't care anything for their own happiness. Their only happiness is to see that Krishna is satisfied. But when Krishna is satisfied, they feel pleasure a million times over. This is what goes on in the spiritual world. It is like that. If you want to hear, let me give you just a brief description about real kama. There's an account of this in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which here it is. Can't find it all of a sudden. Just when you want it, it disappears, huh? I know. Okay, here it goes. Yeah. Ramananda Roy is talking with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Remember they had this discussion about what's the highest thing? So finally Ramananda Roy comes to this point. And he recites a series of verses, one of which is, the last one of which is like this. These are verses of his own composition, by the way. He cites this verse, a Sanskrit text. Oh my Lord, you live in the forest of Govardhan Hill, and like the king of elephants, you are expert in the art of conjugal love. O Master of the universe, your heart and Sri Mati Radharani's heart are just like shellac. That kind of waxy, sort of inflammable product that you put on things to make them, on wood to make them shiny, shellac. Are just like shellac and are now melted in your spiritual perspiration. Therefore, one can no longer distinguish between you and Srimati Radharani. Now you have mixed your newly invoked affection, which is like vermilion, you know, this red in the part of it, with your melted hearts, and for the benefit of the whole world, you have painted both your hearts red with this great palace, within this great palace of the universe. So Mahaprabhu says, yeah, you've reached the limit. He said, there's no higher you can go. And then so Ramananda Roy says, you know, I'm just speaking by your mercy. And then he wants to, then there's some request to explain it further. And then he starts talking about the gopis. Without the help of the gopis, no one can understand this kind of love. And he says here, there's an inexplicable fact about the natural inclinations of the gopis. Now here they're like teenage girls in love with a really great guy. Just like you see in this world. The gopis never want to enjoy themselves with Krishna personally. But this is extraordinary. They're in love with Krishna. It's romantic love, or as Prabhupada says, conjugal love. But they never want to enjoy themselves with Krishna personally. The happiness of the gopis increased 10 million times when they serve to engage Sri Sri Radha and Krishna in their transcendental pastimes. By nature, Srimati Radharani is just like a creeper of love of Godhead. He means like a vine. Creeper means like a vine that wraps around a tree. Radharani is just like a creeper of love of Godhead. And the gopis are the twigs, flowers, and leaves of that creeper. When the nectar of Krishna's pastimes is sprinkled on that creeper, the happiness derived by the twigs, flowers, and leaves is 10 million times greater than that derived by the creeper itself. He says, although the gopis, Srimati Radharani's friends, do not desire to enjoy themselves directly with Krishna. In other words, this is extraordinary. They're absolutely in love with Krishna, but they think that Radharani loves him better than they do, and that she can satisfy Krishna better than they can. So they make all the arrangements. I mean, this is unheard of in the material world. You know, there's nothing in the world quite like a sexual jealousy for driving people out of their minds. And the more intense the sexual attraction, the more great the jealousy. But here they have this very intense attraction to Krishna, but there's no feeling of possessiveness. In other words, their concern is that Krishna enjoys. They don't think about their own enjoyment. So therefore, it says here, they want to make arrangements for Radharani and Krishna to be together. Although the gopis, Srimati Radharani's friends, do not desire to enjoy themselves directly with Krishna, Srimati Radharani makes a great endeavor to induce Krishna to enjoy himself with the gopis, presenting various pleas for the gopis. Srimati Radharani sometimes sends the gopis to Krishna just to enable them to associate with him directly. At such times, she enjoys a happiness 10 million times greater than that enjoyed through direct association. So here's the other thing. When you forget about your own pleasure and simply think of Krishna's pleasure, your pleasure is actually even greater. So these are not the rules of the material world, are they? This is a special place. This transcendental mellow is nourished by the mutual behavior and transcendental love of Godhead. When Lord Krishna sees how the gopis have developed pure love for him, he becomes very satisfied. It is to be noted that the natural characteristic of the gopis is to love the Supreme Lord. That is to say, it is natural. It's inbuilt. But nothing has to happen to make it come out. It's just instinct. So it's natural. Their lusty desire is not to be compared to material lust. Nonetheless, because their transcendental desire sometimes appears to resemble material lust, their love for transcendental love for Krishna is sometimes described as lust. Lusty desires are experienced when one is concerned with his own personal sense gratification. The mood of the gopis is not like that. Their only desire is to satisfy the senses of Krishna. Among the gopis, there's not a pinch of desire for sense gratification, that is to say, their own senses. Their only desire is to give pleasure to Krishna, and that is why they mingle with him and enjoy with him. So this is actually love in the spiritual world. When a living entity comes to the material world, then it becomes my desire to enjoy. One has changed from being a servant of Krishna to being a competitor with Krishna. That is what happens. So that this desire to enjoy in the world, this is where it comes from. In the Bhagavatam, it's called Krishna Apetasya. Or in Bengali, Krishna Bahiramukhi, turning the face away from Krishna. Turning the face away from Krishna. Then this propensity to love Krishna goes away. It just now becomes redirected, and it's manifest as lust. So the project, actually, the real project, is to reconvert, by devotional service, to reconvert that lust back into love for Krishna. Then you can be fulfilled. It's not that, of course, in the beginning of devotional service, we seem to ourselves to be like divided. Sometimes in books on psychology of religion, the divided self. And it's true. We become divided in the beginning stages of Krishna consciousness. We decide we want to become devotees. But we have a mind that's been conditioned to try to enjoy in the world. And Prabhupada describes the mind as the repository, the storehouse of all ideas of sense gratification. So we decide to become devotees, but the mind doesn't go along. It still has the old habits. And so, as is described in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the mind is our enemy. And so we are in a state of internal conflict. Now, this does not always look healthy to people. Even when I became a devotee, my friend said to me, "What's wrong with you? You used to be so together." That was the word. "You used to be so together. Now you're so uptight." Because it was true. I was one with my mind, and we flowed together. I was at ease, enjoying in the material world. And now I was a divided person. Because I was doing something they weren't trying to do. I was trying to convert my mind to becoming a devotee. So we find ourselves in this position. Of course, when the mind becomes the friend, then again you can become together. Then the mind is conquered, then it becomes your best friend. You have the habits of devotional service. So it's only a temporary phase. And all my concluding word is that, you have to stop now. It's worth it. It's worth it. These people who do not try to convert the mind, who are controlled by it, they remain, their lust drives them through repeated birth and death in the material world. And they do not get what they want. What everybody wants is happiness that doesn't come to an end. Because whatever happiness you have comes to an end, immediately you feel upset about it because you wanted to keep on going. And you wanted to keep on going forever. We're still looking for eternal happiness. We can't help ourselves because we're spirit souls. We're looking for it in a place where everything is temporary. This is a futile a kind of existence. And so we will continue to suffer until we learn where to look. That's what, and that means that when we find out how to convert this lust back into love for God, then we will be satisfied. Okay, thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada. I guess we don't have time for discussion. Huh?
Some would like to say
something. Okay, all right. If you want to talk, come up here.
It's very, very beautiful.
Okay.
You know, problem is the happiness is always increasing in the spiritual world. And this is a change. This goes against the idea that the spirit is eternal and steady, it's unchanging. Somehow there's a fluctuation going on. Seems to be this is a contradiction.
No.
Why not?
Because you have to see what kind of thing you mean by change. Prabhupada says it's always dynamic.
And dynamic means that it's not static. So obviously there's a mind-body idea of changes. It's a stasis.